Blog Talk Radio.
It's going to be so good. Well, I am so excited because the sun wasn't out, but it's back out now, so it's going to be great. And I've got three unbelievable authors, and wait till you hear about the topic for this show. I'm going to do a little crazy introduction. First of all, this is Fran Lewis. This is Literary Viewpoint, and this is MJ Network, and we are going to really turn up the heat today. We've got the author of Mad Dog Justice, Mad Dog House, Love Gone Mad, and Lover's Tango, and Mark Rubenstein is here, and he's going to talk about his bad guys in just a moment. We're going to heat up the discussion with him. Then we've got Larry Thompson, who's bad guy in Insanity Play. He's got to bring him back. I'm serious. This guy's, you got to write a sequel. And Dark Money was absolutely first rate. It came out January 25th, so why haven't you read it, people? And trying her hand at horror and getting that 5 stars because she deserved it, The Devil's Pawn, and Marilyn Levinson is here. Hi, everybody. Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning, Fran. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Fran.
Hi, Mark. I am so excited that I'm finally able to do this today. Yes, And today we're going to talk about the bad guys. And, Mark, you're really good at creating the bad guys. So when you created Ronnie Dowell, Dolan, and Danny Burns, and my favorite one is Bill Shaw, I have to tell you, because that was the scariest book I've read so far. Did you create the character with a character sketch, or did you just come up with their traits? And if any one of them could come back, which one would you bring back? I mean, those two are still here. Is Mark here? Is Mark Rubenstein here? Okay, Larry,
if you could bring...
Is Mark here? He was here a second ago. His mic is on. Okay, Larry, if you could bring back the guy in Insanity Plea, what would you do?
Well, that's interesting. The guy in Insanity Plea is Frederick Park. He's a psychiatrist. If you picture Hannibal Lecter, you'll get an idea about his personality. As you know, I've been a trial lawyer for a long time, and I ran across a psychiatrist as an expert witness against me probably 20 years ago, and I decided that I would model Frederick Park after this real-life psychiatrist, and did so. If I were to bring him back, first of all, at the end of Dead Peasants, he's being led out of the courtroom, presumably to some mental institution. So if I were to bring him back, first of all, he'd have to find a way to get out of the mental institution, which he's a smart guy. He could probably do that. And he's an expert witness, is how he makes his living. And he also works for police departments and the BAU, FBI, all of the law enforcement organizations. And if I were to bring him back, I'd probably bring him back, and he would probably volunteer by phone to assist in some mass murder investigation, maybe a terrorist investigation, but not disclose his whereabouts and see where the story goes from there.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to Mark. He was there, and I just emailed him again. So I don't know. It's ever so often. I lost my connection before, so it just could be whatever. Okay, so Marilyn, Uncle Raymond scared the what out of me. And poor Simon. Wait, let me let Mark back in. Hold on a minute. Mark, is that you?
Yes. Somehow or other, we got cut off.
I don't know. I had a problem before,
welcome back,
too. Oh, I'm so glad you're back. Yeah, because I was talking and I saw that you were there, but I don't know, I lost my connection on my thing before too. So Marilyn's going, and then I want to ask you the same question. I don't know if you heard me. When you created Roddy Dowlin and Danny Burns, and my favorite, the scariest one was your last one, Lover's Tango. If you could bring back one of these characters, well, they're all there. If you were going to do another series, which one would you bring back first?
Well, I've been pressed by so many readers to bring back Roddy Dolan and Danny Burns, who, by the way, aren't really bad guys. They're good guys, but they're in a bad situation, and certainly some of the bad, if you want to call them, elements in their psyches are operative, as can be the case for any one of us. But I would bring back Danny and Roddy, and as a matter of fact, I'm thinking of a third Mad Dog book just to round out the trilogy. Bill Shaw is an interesting guy, a writer who's accused of murdering his own wife, whom he loved very dearly, simply because in The Lover's Ego, the novel in progress has elements very, very similar to the way in which his wife in real life died, and he has to go on trial because of that, and some other non-fortuitous elements. But I would bring back any one of them, although you never want to repeat yourself, and you're always looking for new ideas, new sources, new characters, mm-hmm. although if you have a fully developed enough character, you can take that character along for four or five more novels. Who knows? That's what series are all about, I guess.
Well, Bill Shaw was scary because that ending was like, I sort of figured that out. I go, oh, my God. That was,
yeah.
That was,
well, Mark,
that was
you, real. Mark, you make an interesting point about series, but usually our series are based on the protagonist as opposed to the villain. So that's an interesting concept to do a series based on the villain.
Yeah, of course, to some extent, you had mentioned, I heard you mention Hannibal Lecter, and of course, he's become iconic as not only a series character, but possibly even as the protagonist, although, he's certainly not the protagonist in the first, in Red Dragon, but... protagonists come in all shapes, sizes, and forms, and Jack Reacher's a great guy, but he could be pretty tough and ruthless when he has to be. And the interesting thing I always wonder is the bad guys often die, and the protagonists rarely die, but I have read a couple of really good thrillers in which the protagonist does die in the end.
That's so
very
sad.
Very unusual, isn't it?
I know. John
Lethcourt
does that to me.
Well,
John
speaking of Hannibal, there was a TV series based on Hannibal. I started watching it, and then I stopped watching it when I saw what he was serving for dinner.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I got bored with it. It's the second season, I quit.
Right.
Yeah. I get bored with most series, other than Breaking Bad and The Sopranos and a few others, House of Cards and The Americans. A lot of the others, after one or two seasons, they wear themselves out.
You're right.
You know.
But I've been watching Dexter, speaking of murderers and protagonists who kill.
I watched the entire, I think it was 7 years or 8 years, I forget, I watched every single one.
Well, I'm just watching it now, so it's interesting. But as you're right about series, they do get a little repetitive, I think so.
Yeah, but Marilyn, your character of Uncle Raymond was scary. And poor Simon. How did you create that? And are you going to give Simon, are you going to bring him back? Because he's got, powers too, poor thing.
You know something I never considered writing? I don't know why I wrote that book. I know we're supposed to say there's a reason why we write these books. I have, when you've written many books, you really have no idea. Sometimes it's an incident. But I guess the thought behind this was someone trying to take over someone's body. And I think that was I was concerned with in this, because Uncle Raymond has his evil powers, and he knows he's dying. He kills children. A cozy reviewer was very appalled by this book. I know.
Really?
I know she was upset by it, because that's one of the rules in writing cozies. You do not kill children. And in the very first chapter, a little girl is dead because it temporarily keeps Raymond alive. And the funny thing is, I never considered writing a sequel to this, but a few people said they would like to see sequels. I wouldn't bring Raymond back as because he is dead, but I would create another character, another relative, because these powers run through the family. And if I were to write a sequel, and it would have to get in line, it's very bad to start all these different series, and then you have to keep up with them, and you have all these series demanding, you know, different, you know, new books. And I'm just writing a new series, a new cozy series. But I would bring in a relative, of course, who Simon had never seen, who is as evil as Raymond and as powerful as Simon, because it's a basic good versus evil kind of situation. But I would make him young this time with different powers.
Speaking of series and bringing back characters or you know, a series protagonist, I think it's often readers who drive the impetus to into a series or extend the series. I mean, I can't tell you how many times on Goodreads, on Amazon, people emailing this, that, and the other thing on my website, people asking, are you bringing Roddy Dolan back? You know, is he going to turn Mad Dog into a trilogy? It's two books now. Can you turn it into a Mad Dog trilogy? And I'm reluctant to, simply because these are not cops, they're not detectives, they're not lawyers where another case comes along. These are two guys who just a physician and an accountant who find themselves in horrible straits and who have to use their brains and their skills and their basic street toughness to get out of them. And after a while, I feel I'm really stretching things, and I can only take these two characters just so far without you know drawing the line of stretching credulity to the point where it becomes totally unbelievable. And but readers want more, and you know, it's sometimes.
I agree. I think that's why I was having a problem with the book that I was writing before, because I have a ghost who wants in the first book, and it works perfectly. He wants to know who killed him, and people wanted him brought back, and I had to have a good reason, which I created. But I never struggled with a book as much as I did with that one, and I think you made a very good point that, you're working on, because they're the ones who suggested it.
Well, how do you
explain when you're talking about series and you kind of run out of, you think the well starts to run dry, but then we've got Lee Child, who's on probably his 18th Jack Reacher story.
Well, you know what's interesting about the Jack Reacher, and I never realized that until a very good friend of mine, John Land, the great writer, John mentioned to me that the strange thing about Jack Reacher. Also, he mentioned that this also holds true for Ian Fleming's James Bond. These guys don't really have any backstory. If you look at all the Reacher novels except Personal, which is the latest one or next to last one, none of them really give you any significant backstory about his childhood or his background. He just exists de novo. He just exists.
Well, I don't know. There are bits about his mother and his brother.
Little bits,
Here and there in the story, in the different books, a little bit.
But you don't have a full-fledged understanding of how he became who he is. And I think with that kind of a character, it makes him so much more malleable. You can take him almost anywhere because there's almost nothing beyond his reach, and he is almost superhuman. I mean, has he ever been beaten in a fight? You know.
Not yet.
He travels all over.
That's very important. He travels, and so there are different sites for you know, different settings.
So
we don't get bored with them.
Not only that,
I don't get bored with any of you guys, but you know what, Mark? You have Tommy. And in the last novel, I got the feeling that he's not such a sweet little kid.
Well, that was in Mad Dog House and Mad Dog Justice. Tommy is Roddy's son, and people have said to me, why don't you have Tommy growing up and doing some very bad things? Ultimately, we write for ourselves. We write because we love to do it, and there's some inner demon driving us. But on the other hand, ultimately, you find that to some extent, hopefully less more than more, you're guided and driven to some extent by your readers. Yeah, they want more, and they want this, and they want that. And ultimately, many of us fall prey to the marketplace. I want to move on, but the readers, I guess it's also a sign you've written something that really resonates and rings some bells for people. But on the other hand,
What do you want to move on to?
Well, I love stories that are not big stories. I don't like CIA and FBI.
I agree.
I like smaller stories about people, about a person who's flawed and in conflict and who really has to fight his own inner demons to get through some horrible situation. You can call it a small story, but it's something more personal that I think every reader can really relate to, and not Superman, but somebody who really is vulnerable and has flaws and is a character, perhaps not unlike the reader's own self. So I'm drawn to these people, and I want to just plumb different things, guilt and conflict and love and revenge, all these different conflictual kinds of emotional feelings that can drive a character to do stupid things,
Yeah. Well, I'm more of a traditional mystery, which I love to write those because I love to write about people's interactions with one another and all the different connections.
And that's
what I love to explore because, I'm writing about a cold case and my sleuth is involved with his son. And he's first beginning to learn things about his mother. And she's also seeing that he's really not for her romantically. But that's what I love to explore the most, is people's relationships. Of course, there are murders, but that just adds to it.
But what I love to explore, not only the relationships and the conflicts contained in those relationships, but I love the thriller notion of having the protagonist in terrible danger of either getting killed or harmed or his loved ones being harmed or of being found guilty of something he didn't do or some terrible danger that awaits the protagonist and therefore, to some extent, I hope, gets the reader biting his or her nails.
Yes.
Well,
I did in
Love Gone Mad, the elevator scene. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's probably the scariest thing I ever wrote.
Yeah,
can you describe that scene a little bit?
Yes,
in which a young, beautiful, lovable nurse in a hospital finds herself in the locker room at the end of her shift, and she feels a cold draft of air, and she looks up, and down this row of lockers sees a hooded character wearing a skull mask, and he's wearing a huge winter parka with the hood up, and he has a huge kitchen knife, and he's approaching her, and she runs, and she finds herself in the old section that's virtually abandoned of the hospital, and she runs through a series of rooms and ends up hiding in this room containing old equipment and, filled with mouse droppings and God knows what else. And he stands there, and she finally manages to sneak out through a side door and down an abandoned hallway to an old elevator and gets in the elevator. And just as he bursts through, she is in the elevator. The door closes, and she goes up to the fourth floor of this abandoned old section of the hospital. The door opens, and she hears him storming up the steps, so she presses the closed door button and the door closes just as he pounds on the elevator door. And to make a long story short, because it goes on for a number of pages, she goes down in the elevator and gets stuck between the third and the fourth floor. The door opens and she's facing a brick wall. And she knows this maniac is up there on the fourth floor, and then finally the elevator starts inching up slowly so that she looks through this wire meshed plexiglass window in the door, and it's only about 4 inches from the landing, and she sees him looking through, and he's pounding on the door, and God Almighty, if the elevator rises another 2 inches and the door opens, that's going to be the end of her, and I won't tell you the rest of it. But it's a really scary scene. I mean,
it was really scary. So my question is,
my heart was thumping as I was writing it. I broke out into a cold sweat. My scalp was damp.
Yeah, and I was shaking and had to go under the covers and hide and put the light on because it was scary. And after
me,
that,
tell,
I
me, tell me the name of this book.
Tell
me the name of this book, Mark. I want to get on Amazon.
That book is called Love Gone Mad. Love Gone
Mad. Oh, God,
mad.
It was really too scary.
It's a standalone.
And
it came after. It came after the first two Mad Dog books, Mad Dog House and Mad Dog Justice, Love Gone Mad. And the latest one is The Lover's Tango, which is a courtroom medical thriller, legal drama. I try and mix it up. Everybody says,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't write the same genre all the time. I
That's
try and go
true.
From, yeah.
Well, that's why
know.
Larry's got to write another one for that other character because he scared me too. God, that last one. An insanity
the last,
plea.
The insanity plea. Yeah. Well, he'll come back at some point, as will those the four characters that were trying to track him down. Frederick Park was kind of an interesting way I developed that because within the first 15 or 20 pages, the reader knew who the villain was, knew everything about him, knew he was a psychiatrist, knew where he lived. Mm. Knew what he was going to do, and then the reader stayed with the story because they had to go to the end to see if he was caught. And so it was a little different take on writing a novel like that.
Yeah,
but
there are different ways.
It worked very well.
Yeah, different ways to do suspense. You can either reveal the bad guy right away, and then it's a matter of is he going to get the good guy or are they going to catch the bad guy? Or
yeah.
You can do the whodunit routine, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Who did it and why and what were the motivations? And then you can go into, well, is the bad guy going to get away and come back to kill again? There are so many ways to draw out suspense, which I think is probably the bottom line when you're trying to, at least plot-wise, hold the reader's attention.
Well, you certainly did, because especially with the way that Bill supposedly killed his wife, and
that
I know a lot about.
Well, that's the allegation against them, yeah. Well,
yeah, that was the allegation, and I know a lot about that because of my mom, so I said, oh, my God, yeah, that could really happen. And in my new book, everybody, Hidden Truths and Lies, My Face is Behind the Stone series, my nephew wrote the story about a baseball player with me, and he said, well, why don't we use a combination of these two things to kill off the character? So I had to do some research on that, and it was really fun to write it. Really fun to kill off a whole lot of people too.
You know, I've always found that it's my belief. I don't know that everybody shares this, but I think equally, if not more important than plot, is the character, the who. The reader has to invest in and care about the character. There's a very simple example that I use when I'm describing this, when I talk at the libraries or whatever. We all remember that horrifying tsunami that occurred back a number of years ago, where about 500,000 people in Southeast Asia died. Well, on the day that happened, I remember I and everybody I spoke with, we all said, oh, my God, what a horror. But then, you know, we went about the rest of our day. What a horrible thing, and you read about it in the newspaper that day or the next day and whatever, and it was a horrible thing, but you went about your day. But if one of those people who died in that cataclysmic event had been someone you love, a wife, a husband, a brother, a sister, you
would
have been impacted.
Situation.
Altogether different. You'd have been impacted for the rest of your life. So
my
only point is that you got to care about the character as much as you care about what happens. It's the who that the reader invests in as much, if not more, than the what of what occurs to the character. So
I wonder what would happen if you use something like the tsunami or a huge hurricane or a horrible storm where people die and have one character live and commit murder and use it as a basis to start your next novel.
Well, it's the old story. If you ask yourself, what if, you know, about any news item or any situation, you can come up with a plot line. The question is, can you make a character for whom the reader is going to really care?
I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
Which kind of puzzles me. Some of the books that are coming out now have characters about whom I don't care, like Gone Girl and characters like that. And and yet this seems to be the hottest type of genre these days.
You know, that's interesting you mentioned that Gone Girl, because I tried to read that book, and I gave up about 150 pages and said, I'm not going to read this book anymore. It's still a bestseller.
Exactly, and I felt that way about The Girl on the Train, and I know many fellow writers felt the same way. And then,
that was my other point, yes.
I read a book, let's say, of a similar type, but I thought where you cared about the characters, which was The Husband's Secret. I absolutely loved that book because I felt it was so well written. It's taken from three people's points of view, and they all mesh together, but you care about the characters. You care. And I would say, I hope this passes quickly, the genres that where people don't seem to care about, you know, where the protagonist is not someone you care about.
I have a confession.
Well, it's even harder when you have to review the books and you have to tell them, which I did last week, that somebody's book was really not up to par, and, of course, they weren't happy, and I didn't review it.
Yeah.
So it makes it harder for someone myself.
I have to confess, I really enjoyed Gone Girl for a very specific reason. I thought
I didn't like that plotting.
I thought it was so clever the way she began. He begins on the day of the abduction, and it works back. And she begins at when they first met, and it works its way forward, and then they meet. I thought it was a very compelling dissection of a modern dysfunctional marriage, although I agree the characters were not terribly likable.
No.
But I thought it really told a compelling tale. Same with Gone Girl. I was really very annoyed at the fact that one of the narrators was already dead. I mean, I thought that was really a stretch, you know. But I did think it portrayed this very dysfunctional alcoholic woman and her perceptions of things as being in this other marriage ideal as being so far off the mark. Of course, hey, look, that's what makes horse racing.
By the
way, I also concluded that I'm so tired of seeing all these novels coming out with the word girl in the title.
Yes,
and all these new novels being written by women writers, all being compared to Gone Girl and Girl on the Train. It's all marketing, and, it's like a series character. It can wear itself out.
And it will, They compared The Widow to that type of book as well. I had read The Widow, and again, it's The Widow. She's married to someone who's, she finds out he's bad and all that. And I found it predictable. But again, and somebody who reviewed it on Amazon said, you're doing it a disservice by comparing it to Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train.
Absolutely. I interviewed Fiona Barton for the Huffington Post, and in the interview, she brought out some interesting elements of The Widow, namely that as a reporter, Fiona Barton spent a lot of time in court, and she always found it fascinating wondering what the spouse, almost always a woman, of an accused serial killer, what did the spouse know, and what did the spouse think was really going on? And, it's the old story, the neighbors always say, oh, he was such a nice, quiet guy.
Think about the BTK killer in Wichita, Kansas. He got away with it for all of his killing years.
Who was this?
He went quiet.
BTK.
BTK. Bound, torture, kill.
Bound, torture, kill.
He was a low-level law enforcement officer.
Oh boy!
And he killed just in his own hometown, and he got away with it. And
in his spare time. Yeah.
It was his spare time, and then he went quiet. And after about 10 years, he couldn't bear the fact that nobody knew he did it, and he started writing letters to the Wichita paper, which led to his capture, and he is now serving a life term because they don't have the death penalty. But he was the guy next door. His wife never knew anything about it. His kids were in Little League. He coached Little League, and he didn't go wandering off to other parts of the country. Wichita, Kansas, I've been there. That's not a very big town. I mean, maybe 150, 200,000 or something like that. But he succeeded.
And he brought himself in because he wanted the notoriety. He wanted the recognition.
Yeah.
Wow. That's something.
What I find fascinating as a psychiatrist and as a writer is that every one of us, to one extent or another, you know, given that we have certain controls over who we are and how we behave, every one of us at least has some potential for incredible, almost indescribable evil. It's really a matter of how well and how encompassing our conscience is and our sense of right and wrong may be, how fully developed those areas of our personality are. But, you know, given and we saw this in World War II, we saw it in Nazi Germany, we see it today as we speak in the Middle East, in ISIS and so forth, we see the unlimited potential for evil and for horror that can exist in the human capacity for ill will. And this is something that all mystery writers and thriller writers, and I think many novelists in almost every genre, it's something that gets plumbed in literature.
And I think people like to read them.
Would you ever write a book about ISIS or Hamas? And I'm getting so many of them. And I'm doing a panel show on the 18th of May with Alan Jacobson, Simon Chavez, and a whole bunch of people in that particular field. That's one field that you've never touched on. So I'm curious to know, would you write anything like that? And how would you define the word evil?
Oh my God! I wouldn't write a psychiatrist.
Go ahead.
Somebody's got to define the word villain and evil because they're all different. I mean, and guess who's read over 5,000 books based on that? And I've read the last couple of books is like another terrorist attack. Oh my God! I don't even care. I hope they win.
I guess I would never write a book about ISIS or Hamas, because these are those big books that is true. They're the big political thrillers, the CIF, FBI kinds of international thriller, the spy things that I'm just not really drawn to them at all. As a matter of fact, when publishers send me those books, for consideration for the Huffington Post to interview the authors, I characteristically turn them down. As far as evil is concerned, I'm not sure I'm capable of defining evil other than to say that it's the abandonment of those internalized embodiments of what we are hopefully taught as children to do unto others as we'd like to have done unto us. I mean, I guess that's the simplest way to just, if one abandons that, if one just allows one's most instinctual desires to take over without any filter, I guess that qualifies to be termed the capacity for and the ability to act on evil inclinations and to then do evil.
I'm reading a book by Pembroke Sinclair. It's called Something Versus Good Versus Evil, and it's about three young people, a young girl, and she has to choose between her best friend and this guy that comes in, and one's actually a demon, and the other one is supposed to get rid of the demons. So would anybody ever write a book? I mean, you write YA books, Marilyn. You wrote that one. Would you ever write a book of good versus evil as far as
I have a children's book, and the boy finds that his family has they're all witches. I wrote this book before Harry Potter, the first one, by the way, and it ended up being a children's choice. The boy, he really doesn't want to become a witch on one hand, because then he's going to have to do good deeds and take courses, and he's kind of a timid kid, and he has the bullies always after him. Magic runs amok. And in the second book, which should be coming out soon, he's in the south of France with friends, and they save this girl. It's called The Witch's Slave, because again, it's about witches. But in the third book, I do have good versus evil. He has this uncle who is an evil witch. And Rufus is getting sick and tired of doing good deeds, and the uncle wants an heir apparent, and he starts wooing Rufus, who's basically a good kid. So I think in many ways we do bring in good versus evil in our books, and I think it's more apparent when in these science fiction books where somebody has to save the world's going, a group of evil scientists or evil people are taking over the world, and the band of good you know, the heroes have to save the world or the society from those people. And I think that reading is like, reading mysteries is very much like men who, most, well, not just men, but people who watch sports events. You know, it's a vicarious thrill. It's what if, you know, they're experiencing dealing with death and danger and murder. And they, you know, if it's a good book, you do get a glimpse into the murderer and why they killed. So,
what about yours in, not Insanity, but in Dark Money? You're gonna keep the son in there, JD, right?
Yes, I intend to keep him in, and this is my take on a series. This is my second Jack mm-hmm. Bryant book, and the only reason I wrote it is because I had a lot of readers that said, we want to hear more about Jack Bryant. And so I said, okay, then I will write a Jack Bryant story. And for those of you who are not familiar with Jack, he has a young son who is an All-American football player at TCU in Fort Worth that gets drafted by the Cowboys. And he works with his dad in solving some of these mysteries. And I've kept him active because at some point I'm going to dip into the National Football League and write a mystery about the National Football League. And I haven't thought anything more than that. But Jack Bryant will be a key part of it. It's kind of interesting how this all came together, this Dark Money, because I have a son-in-law who was part of Governor Perry's protective detail here in Texas as part of the Department of Public Safety. And he came up with this idea one day. He said, you know, we have a conflict. If the governor is ever in danger, we are supposed to get the governor out of harm's way at all costs. But at the same time, we are sworn law enforcement officers, which means we're supposed to protect the public. So what happens if we get in a situation where the governor is in danger, but people are getting killed? Mm-hmm. What do we do? And he says about half of us in the governor's protective detail believe that we take care of the governor, and the other half says, no, we've got to protect the public. And so he says that conflict might work into a novel for you, and that did. I wrote Dark Money with that mm-hmm. as one of the primary premises of it. And the other, of course, is the corruption of money in politics that bothers me as a citizen after the Citizens United decision about 6 or 7 years ago, where the floodgates have been thrown open as far as anybody with $1 billion can sway an election now without even having to identify themselves. So I combined those two as themes and wrote Dark Money. But as you know, Fran, not nearly all of my stories have some underlying message. And in this one, while it's a very good thriller, as you know, I still wanted to get across the message that we have a problem in our society when billionaires can change elections just by throwing their money at it and never even have to disclose who they are.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like watching some of the debates on television. Mm-hmm. It's scary.
Yeah, it is. I'm definitely not a Trump supporter, but I think I can tell you that it resonates with people when he says, "I'm not taking anybody mm-hmm. else's money. I'm spending my own money." And
he's still a billionaire, and he's a crypto fascist.
Yeah, well, that's true too.
And I thought it was just me that thought that.
he's not so crypto when you really get down to it. And if you look at the way he talks and some of the things he says and some of the implicit thematic infrastructures of what he does, pointing to the outsiders, this, that, and the other thing, it really does. It parallels fascism, European fascism in the 30s.
It's scary. I read an article just recently
that said that compared him to Hitler.
Oh God!
Well, there are parallels. There are many, many parallels. Yeah. There are. But getting away from all that stuff, I mean, well, we're talking about evil. So
I love talking about evil because at this particular point, it just resonates through me lately.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
So if you could create a character with your main character, if you could put your main character in a really scary setting with a villain, what would you come up with? If you could change the setting or come up with a new main character, where do you think would be the scariest place to put them with a villain?
Anywhere.
Go ahead.
I
was just going to comment. I think in a public environment, it could be a cocktail party. It could be on a street. It could be in a theater. I think it would be a public environment where they come together, and then there's the risk of not only the good guy being harmed, but of other people being killed.
I think.
Well, what about that
first
eye contact? That would be really cool.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think you can put a villain and a protagonist anywhere. It doesn't really matter whether it's in public.
Yeah.
I think some of the scariest elements are whether they meet in public or there's the first encounter elsewhere. When the protagonist is at home in a presumably safe place, I mean, you know, when you're home, you feel, this is where I belong. And when you feel in some way as though you're either being watched or stalked
or asleep
in your bed, and you know, when you and your loved ones are possibly vulnerable, I mean, actually, if you've created enough conflict and enough tension and suspense, it barely matters where it all takes place.
I agree with Mark. I think so, yeah.
That's scary. What would happen, though, if somebody came into your house and literally, you know, tried to attack your family and stuff, and you actually killed them, and they arrested you, even though that you are not guilty?
Well, that's the example of how anyone could really murder. That's an example.
Yeah.
When you're
pushed to
something, that's what you do.
But I think in most states there is an exception when it comes to defending yourself or your family within the confines of your own home. Not outside the home, as the so-called stand your ground law is in Florida.
But in
most states, if you're in your home and an intruder comes in, you are within your rights in terms of defending
yourself
to do anything that is necessary to protect yourself, including using a weapon to kill the intruder. But the act of being intruded upon, the thought of there being someone out there, whether it's a cat and mouse scenario or just a stalking scenario, of someone following you, of looking in your rearview mirror in your car and seeing that same vehicle behind you, these are frightening things.
Even hang-up calls?
That's even worse.
That's even worse. That's horrible.
Serious emails. I mean, today with technology, somebody hacking into your Twitter account or to your Facebook, posting obscene messages or threatening messages with these server proxies people can use. I mean, that's the other thing that's changed about mystery and thriller writing today.
Electronic technology.
You know, you can't have a protagonist in an unreachable place anymore. So long as you've got cell phones and cell
towers. No, but they don't always work. They don't always work, so you could always do that.
Yeah, that's the out.
There are places.
Yes.
Yeah, but before I forget, let me remind, on Monday, this is going to be big, people. Anybody that wants to listen? At 12 o'clock, a special time, only because of who it is, New York Times bestselling author Philip Margolin is doing an interview with me for Violent Crimes. And speaking about evil, you're going to love the definition of that word, those two words, in different context. On March 3rd, Vincent Zandri and Orchid Grove. On March 10th, Goodbye to the Dead with Brian Freeman. It's pretty good, right? On March 16th, we got Carl Brookins. And on March 24th, I'm so excited, Thin a Black Line with Simon Chavez. And to round out the month, one of my favorite people, Alan Topol, The Italian Divide, will be here. But Monday should be exciting at 12 o'clock in the afternoon because he's Pacific time. So that should be fun. So before we close, I got a few more questions. So the main character works very hard to find the villain. And an investigator or some other way. Mark, do you use your background in psychology or law enforcement in order to create your novels and take down the bad guy, or not take down the bad guy?
Well, I use the background. I think we all use our backgrounds, our experience in living, our education, training, experiences, whatever they may be. As a physician, a psychiatrist, and as someone having done forensic psychiatry, that really became important in The Lover's Tango, as well as in Love Gone Mad, where there's an insanity plea. On the other hand, I think every writer uses to one extent or another experience, not necessarily in creating the villain, but in general, just in creating whatever you create, situations, scenarios, background. I mean, if you know about hospitals, if you know about the law, law firms, if you know about how an automobile works, if you're a car buff or if you know about weapons, if you've been in the army, I mean, if you've lived life, you bring those experiences, that understanding, and of course there's always the internet, which is a tremendous source of information. You bring it all to the writing, and you know, there was a time when we all had to go to the library and sit there for hours on end, maybe come out with a page worth of stuff. That's no more. Now you just sit at your computer and you access basically the world. So I try to bring everything that I've ever seen, heard, or lived, as well as what I can do a little bit of research on. I try not to go too heavy on the research, but I bring it all to the novel and to everything I try to write.
Well, the fact that you used Coumadin in the last one was really brought it to home, because I know my mom took Coumadin, and I'll never forget, she called me up one day. She said, the doctor said to take 2 milligrams, 3 and 4. I go, Mama, he said 2 today, 3 today, tomorrow, and 4 the next day. She took it all at once, needless to say.
Oh, geez.
So,
wow.
Yeah, she wound up in the hospital with a bleed out.
Yeah, a hemorrhagic phenomenon in the brain. I hate to say it, but it happens with more frequency than we'd like to even know. That again goes to the notion. I mean, if you look at the older population, people over 60, 65, some very significant portion of them take Coumadin or warfarin or some blood.
Or Xarelto or Eliquis or some of those new ones.
Yeah,
the novel ones
that
they're called these days.
K dependent. Yeah. And if you have a scenario in your novel where this kind of medication is taken, you're tapping into a ready-made audience of a few million people who can relate to it and to the dangers attendant upon taking that medication. So, you know, everything that you know or do or research can potentially feed into the suspense of the novel and to the applicability of whatever you're trying to describe to the audience. And the audience, the more people who can relate to what you're talking about and describing, the better, hopefully, the book is going to do.
Yeah, my mother took it since, I don't think she was like 20, 21. She had, you know, the problem. So I used that.
She probably had atrial fibrillation like Nora did in the novel.
She was in and out of whatever, so I used it in one of my stories in Faces Behind the Stone to sort of kill off somebody, because the pharmacist told me that if you use a certain amount of, I won't say how much, Coumadin, it does the trick. So, you know, what can I say? Everything
does
in that
the
book,
trick,
you know, it's
traceable.
I made sure that my research was right.
If you get somebody who's in the hospital and on an IV line and you want to kill them, you use potassium chloride.
Yeah, that's what scares me.
And it stops the heart, and it's undetectable in especially if the person's not on a low salt diet.
Read Mercy by Daniel Parma, and you'll see what happens when his physician-assisted murder. He sent it to me, and I have to say, thank you, Daniel. The book's not out yet, but guess who got quoted on the back cover? That would be me.
Oh, that's very nice.
Yeah, I was so excited. I had no idea, and I read the book in, like, you know, one of Fran's warp times. So before we close, what are you working on, and who's going to be your next bad guy, and are you going to make him really dangerous? It has to be dangerous. I make sure I get it first, because I need to get it first. I need to read. I've been getting an awful lot of books that I've been, like, putting aside. And I have to be honest, if it takes me more than 2 hours or 3 hours to read a book, you're in big trouble. Seriously.
You are
it takes
amazing,
me more than 2 days.
I don't know how you can read so fast.
You're the world's fastest reader.
I was told to slow down, but I haven't heard. My doctor said to me the other day, you know, your eyes. I go, yeah, so you have on upset too. What can I say? If something is really, really good, like all of your books, I'm going to be in trouble. And if something is just mediocre, and maybe it's just as well, it takes me 3 days to read the book. So what is everybody working on, and where can we find out more about everyone?
Go ahead.
Well, I'll start off. I'm not.
Okay.
My next book is not a thriller. It has to do with my brother. His name was Tommy Thompson. He was a true crime writer back in the 80s, and along the lines of Truman Capote, and he was an international bestseller.
Oh.
He wrote a book called Blood and Money about murders in the rich part of Houston. There were three libel cases that came out of that. I defended all three of them and won all three of those cases for him and for Doubleday. But after all these years, this is how slowly things work in Hollywood. Finally, they're going to make a streaming video of Blood and Money, which will be out this probably in the fall or maybe early 2017. I'm going to write. I don't want to call it a memoir because that sounds boring. I'm going to write the story of Blood and Money, the libel trials, because they were fascinating trials with characters that you could not imagine. And so I expect to be working on that in 2016, and then I've got two or three on down the road, but that's my current project.
Well, that sounds interesting. Mark, what are you working on?
Well, I've got two things. I've just finished something. This will be my sixth nonfiction book, the other five going back years ago. This is called Bedlam's Door. The subtitle is True Tales of Madness and Hope. It's 14 short stories that read like fiction, but they're all absolutely true with, of course, all changes to names, places, locales, and other identifiable data. Based on my many years of experience in psychiatry, including forensic psychiatry, emergency room psychiatry, hospital psychiatry, private practice, including my one time being something like Dr. Melfi long before she was even imagined when I treated
Mark, what was the first book that you wrote, the nonfiction?
The first nonfiction, let's see, that was the complete book of cosmetic facial surgery.
No, but did you write a series of stories about patients?
This one's called Bedlam's Door, and this is based on many, many years of psychiatric experience. That's coming out in September. I'm just finishing up another novel that will come out 6 or 8 months after that called Downfall, about a young physician whose father, who's an older physician who still makes house calls, believe it or not, who gets shot one night killed making a house call. The question is, why did that happen? What does it involve? Who did it? Why? And what, if anything, is going to happen to the young doctor? And it's really about their relationship and what it was all about to be the son of a doctor and to have your father at age 64 just blown away. And it goes on. It's a real thriller. But again, I'm always trying to pick out something a little bit different and a little bit not too representative of what I've done before. How about you? What's coming from you?
Marilyn, what are you working on? Tell everybody.
Well, I have a contract with an agent and who thought I had finished the book. I had given her three chapters. I had a series. It's a cozy series about my sleuth works in a library and there's a ghost in it, and it deals with a cold case about a woman who was murdered 15 years ago in the little town, and it's called Death Overdue, and I'm moving right along. I've written a third of it, so I hope to finish it by July, and then I will finish the mystery I've been writing in the middle. I'm in the middle of a sequel to Giving Up the Ghost. And then I want to write my third Rufus, the good versus evil, for the third in the trilogy. That's a children's book.
That sounds so interesting. All of them are interesting, and you have to all send them to me. So how can everybody learn about everybody, and where can they find out information? And Mark, are you coming to the Thriller Fest? Because if I get invited, I'll be there.
I am, and I know you were there last year.
What are you
doing this year?
I'll be there this year.
Oh,
yeah,
you're going to be there.
The
so what classes am I taking? I took the workshops last year, but it wasn't. I thought I missed yours.
I'm on a panel with Kathy Reich's medical issues in thrillers.
Oh.
What day are you giving it?
I'm not sure yet. They haven't finalized the schedule. It'll probably be Friday.
That's perfect.
It's going to be either Friday. It'll be either Friday or Saturday, Fran.
That's great because if John invites me, he better invite me again. I'm going to be really upset. I'm going to definitely go because my husband wants to go to the classes, and I missed Mark last time. I met Kathy Reich, and she gave me her publicist because she wanted me to review her books, and for some reason, it never connected. So
yeah, last year, I interviewed Kathy right after we had our panel. We went to a room, and we sat down. We talked about her book that had just come out, I think it was Speaking in Bones was the name of the book.
I love Bones, and I wanted to review her books, and she wanted me to, but for some reason, the publicist I sent to was not the right one or whatever, and never connected, and I was disappointed. The other one that I never got to, and they keep saying, oh, we're going to try to send it to you, would be Lee Child. I never got the Jack Reacher books either, so that's not fair. I get everybody else, and sometimes just things wind up outside my door, and sometimes I want to send them away, and sometimes I don't want to send them away. What can I say? So where can everybody find everybody's website?
Well, mine's very simple. It's just www.LarryDThompson.com.
Well, Larry Thompson, I'm going to send you my book in about 5 minutes. I send it to Marilyn. So you guys have to tell me. And if there's anything seriously that I messed up on, because there's a couple of things that I might have messed up on, just let me know before I have it published that I got to change it. The first story is based on a real-life incident. I won't tell you what. And the second one, sort of. I changed all the names, and I even changed the profession. And I got permission to use other people's names as the main character. And my cousin read the story, and she got the chills. And she would have told me it was horrible. She said she read it she reads it in 5 days. She read this in 2 hours. She said she couldn't believe it. And the book is it's about 100 pages, not even. So if you have any comments or critiques, please don't hesitate because Fran doesn't get upset.
Okay.
I have to make sure. Can we find out about you? Larry, you're going to help me on the legal end of it.
I am. I will. Just tell me what your deadline is for me getting it back to you when you send it to me.
I just sent it to Robin and Fideli because I love Robin and Fideli. I decided not to go with the traditional publisher for my own reasons. She just sent me two cover pages that we talked about that are really scary. They're great. I figure about 2 or 3 weeks would help because give quotes for the back cover.
I can do that easily.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
By the time you get the book, you'll be reading it faster than whatever. And it's large print, everybody. Marilyn, where can we find out about you and your website?
My website, again, like Larry's, is easy. It's www.MarilynLevinson.com. Or you can go to my Amazon page, which is Marilyn Levinson. I use my name for my same name for every book, every type of book that I write. And it's easy enough.
Well, all of you guys write top-notch books. And lately, I haven't been giving a lot of stars to people. And like I said, as a reviewer, I won't pan a book. If a book isn't 3.5-4 stars, I won't review it. I'll write a synopsis. Which brings me to the fact that I am now on the staff of Michigan Avenue Media with my friend Annabelle Glickman and Marcia Casper Cook, who's listening. And I offered the ability to write, not a book review, a synopsis for the back cover or the synopsis for after the cover. And if you want to know more, go on Michigan Avenue Media and find out what we offer because we do cover reveals and all sorts of things, book tours they do and press releases, and Marcia's really
great.
I'll
send you the arc of Bedlam's Door when it comes out.
You've got to send it to me, yes, because
that
would be really great.
Yeah, if you're interested in psychiatry, legal issues, and most of all conflict, that's going to be right up your alley, Fran.
Well, that would be great because my doctor told me when I came on Sunday for my post-op checkup that I could use some help. No, he said he was trying to tell me something, and I was talking over him. Basically, I didn't want to hear what he had to say.
Uh-oh.
So that's okay. So I would like to thank everybody. And you see, I knew the sun would come back out again. The sun is out. It's a beautiful day, and I hope everybody will come back on again. And I'm doing a panel show on the 18th of May with Simon Chavez and Alan Jacobson and Gail Linz, actually, and a whole bunch of other people. And we're going to talk about how do you write a novel with terrorists about terrorism? How do you put ISIS and Hamas and all of that in your novel to make it accurate? And it should be interesting. So
well,
I
those, are, to those, are, those are very good authors on that subject, by the way. They know that subject very well.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. There are five people that are going to be on the panel. I know Alan Jacobson, Simon Chavez, Gail Lind, and Alan Topol, and one more. And in my mind is like, I don't know why. It should be interesting, and I just hope that it works out that particular day. And if anybody else wants to join the panel, just feel free to just call in that day. It's going to be a lot of fun. And on that note, I hope everybody has a great day. And thank you so very, very much, everyone. And have a nice day, and bye.
Bye-bye,
everybody.
Bye.